Hey, it's Bootstrap Web. We're back. Jordan, what's up, buddy?
Brian, good to be back. This is great.
I'm glad we got this one in because we're always like in between trips, you and I. Like I just came back from like a week or two ago from Martha's Vineyard, a conference over there.
I want to hear about that.
And next week, I'm going to another conference in Cabo, Mexico. So
pretty fancy few weeks.
I think I picked the right industry to go into. That's all I got to say about that.
The Vineyard is a cool, unique spot.
Oh, that was a great time. I love these mini conferences, man. The Big Snow Tiny Comps and the and so Ben Orenstein put on a very similar type of trip, which he called NanoConf, and I went with him and like eight other people to Martha's Vineyard, which is only about like 2 hours away from where my house is, but it's like a pain to get over there from here, actually.
Well, it's an island, so you got to go up there and then take the ferry, which just gives it a very unique feel.
Yeah, and I actually took the train over to Providence and then the ferry, so it was crazy.
Cool. How many people?
Was it eight or nine of us in a little Airbnb on Martha's Vineyard, and I've never been on Martha's Vineyard. It was really cool, awesome vibe, and we just kind of, it wasn't like Big Snow Tiny Comp where we had a big event of like going snowboarding or anything. We just had all this like free time for 3 days. We literally just like walked around the island and we went to restaurants and stuff and like did our sessions wherever, like in a park, on the beach, like at the house, like wherever. It's basically a mastermind session with a bunch of people who've gone to these mini comps over the last couple of years. So
I think the mini comps are appealing because people want that extended time, extended conversation, get to know the people, get to know their businesses, and vice versa. In the MicroConf crew chat that happens here in Portland, people were asking about Big Snow Tiny Conf. And it was interesting to just hear them talk about like, well, I hear it sells out right away and there aren't that many people. So has anyone gone? And then we started talking about doing one here in Portland. But if we keep it to like under 10 people, it won't go past the people in Portland. But it's still, right, we go to lunch once a month. And oftentimes you get a lot of value in a 90-minute lunch get together. It was just extrapolating from there, saying, what if I just hung out with these people for 2 days? It's just a lot more value, and it sounds like fun at the same time.
It's amazing. I want to reach out to Brad. Brad Tunar and I started the first Big Snow Tiny Conf. Maybe he and I can get on some sort of like podcast or a video, and maybe Dave Rodenbaugh too. He's been doing the Colorado one, and Craig Hewitt. And like we could just talk about the model and what's worked for us, because I feel like a lot of other people have emailed me and we hear about it all the time. People want to start up their own versions of this. I really encourage it. It's awesome. I mean, what's been cool for us is like the same people have been coming back year after year. So you not only go deep for 3 days, but it's also like you hear like an annual update from these people. So it's pretty cool.
Well, right. Once a year sounds like a long time, but you just
But we meet at MicroConf and we're in a Slack all year long, so it's, you know.
Right, right. So it ends up being like a touch base, like the same thing. I go to Slovenia every 6 months. It's only twice a year, but just going to dinner, having beers, having breakfast, just that continuous hangout time, it's a lot. And that creates the strength to kind of carry you through to the next time you see each other.
Yeah. And it's actually my only mastermind now. Is like the two Big Snow Tiny Comps is kind of like this combined mastermind.
You should consider doing your thing, the documentation thing that you like to do, and effectively franchising it, right? So it's not like
people always ask that. They're like, can we use the Big Snow Tiny Conf name? I actually just replied to that request today by someone, and you know, to be honest, I think where me and Brad have landed on that is, we're basically done. We've only done it for the Vermont one, the Colorado one, and Europe. Those three go by Big Snow Tiny Conf. But for anybody else who wants to start something up, just
call it something else.
Call it something else.
But I think what would be helpful is almost seeing like your agenda. Like,
yeah,
should it be 2 days? Should it be 3 days?
And it's also like, you know what else? Because with Ben Orenstein, like he just, do it however you want. Like Ben has been going to Martha's Vineyard like all his life, so he knew the island really well, and he had this concept of like
he's hosting.
Yeah, he's hosting, so he knew all the spots, he knew all the restaurants we should go to, and all this stuff. So wherever you're at, whatever place you know, you put it together. You know.
Yeah, I know. Look, it sounds cool. Let's say for myself and a few other people here to do one in Portland, but it would reduce the burden. It's almost like the mental burden to just see, like, just do a welcome dinner, and then you do breakfast, and then you do breakout sessions, and then you do this, and then people, each person presents one night, and then the other half of the people present the next night, and it's just like some type of itinerary. Because right now I think about that and I say, oh, that sounds so cool. And because I don't know what it entails, I think to myself, oh, dude, you don't have time for that. That's going to be too much.
To be honest, I think it's easier than people think. Because it's so small. It's only like, what, 8-10 people, whatever it is. Like with that, it's pretty laid back and you're in a house and you're doing things. And it does help to have a plan so that you're not like, hey, where should we go? But
open source the plan.
I know. Like I was going to have a session. Everybody usually gets some sort of like 20-30 minute session about like whatever they want to talk about. And I had a plan and some notes of how I wanted to fill up my 30 minutes. And I ended up just talking about my stuff and my questions in the casual conversation. Like it wasn't even part of my session. And I was like, well, I basically already talked about the things I wanted to talk about. So that's that. And what I told Ben was, I told the group actually, was that this trip, which happened, what, like 2 weeks ago, it couldn't have come at a perfect time for me because I was in a moment, I still am kind of, where I have all these questions and I'm trying to make some decisions about where I should go next with Process Kit, the software product that I'm designing and starting up right now. I had all these questions about, should I find a technical co-founder? Should I code it myself? What are my options? And a bunch of related questions like that. And so having a trip like that really helped. And I actually came out of the trip with some pretty good conclusions, I think.
Right. So. It sounds like a good time, but tell us like what you got out of it and where you are on those things.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think I talked in the last episode about maybe near the end of the episode where it was like, okay, so I've been designing Process Kit and this year I have been learning how to code. So kind of the original plan was, let me just build it myself and code it. The thing is that it is going to be a very complex product. And so about a month ago, I started getting into discussions with someone about kind of partnering up in like a finding like a technical co-founder or CTO type of person to join me. And those talks went for a little while, but then they ended up concluding with, okay, this is just not going to work. We're in kind of two different situations and we're just going to continue on in touch, but we're not really going to work together on this. So I'm kind of back to square one. I'm deciding to build the MVP myself in Rails, and I was going to do the front end design and markup HTML, CSS myself anyway, working with a Rails person. But for now, I'm just going to go it solo because that's kind of the only option that I have on the table right now. And the thinking is, okay, yes, I risk it's going to take me a long time, like a lot longer than an experienced developer could build something with me. But the way that I'm going to kind of combat that is, A, I have a weekly coach who helps me through all my questions when it comes to code and Rails and best practices and strategy around this product. And B, I could outsource little pieces of the code to people as needed. I'm just not going to outsource the whole thing like I did last time with Ops Calendar. And I didn't really like where that ended up. The goal being, let me just push as hard as I can on getting an MVP up and out to the market. I have this group of hundreds of people in a Facebook group and a Slack group who are giving me feedback on the designs and they're on the early access list and I want to get moving. And the only thing that I can literally do to move that ball forward is to just get to work on the product myself.
And instead of waiting and depending.
Yeah. Instead of like waiting and throwing a ton of cash at just outsourcing it or hoping to find the perfect co-founder. Like, when am I going to find that person? Like, I feel like I'm on a time clock of like, let's just move, you know? And then eventually, like, I still am kind of open to the idea of talking to potential technical partners on this who might want to come in with me. You know, maybe sometime over the next year, it looks like that and they come in with me and maybe they come in and rebuild the whole thing, but at least I got some version out the door and got to a certain point. You know, the challenge with finding the co-founder, and this is what really started to clarify for me when I was in Martha's Vineyard, was it's not just finding any developer. Like, I've hired developers. I still hire developers for things. That's not new to me. I could do that anytime. Yeah, it's difficult, but I've done it before and I can do it. But hiring a developer is much different than finding a business partner in a self-funded bootstrapped startup, a SaaS. So
you get married, man.
You get married, but you also need to find someone that A is very experienced and credible and has the credibility on the tech side, right? Like you can't go with somebody who's like new at this. B, I mean, you probably just need somebody who came off of an exit of a previous company, you know,
or is in a transition period
or is in some sort of transition period.
It's hard.
Because otherwise, if they're not sort of in that situation, then they don't have the savings to live off of for a while, and they don't have the free time. Because there's a lot of really experienced developers who check the first box of the experience box, but they're employed full-time or they're doing consulting full-time. You know, you need somebody who has like a bunch of free time, can come in and bootstrap for, you know, literal or no salary for a while, equity only, and then, you know, defer the salary. And I mean, that's just the hard truth of that. Like and that's a really hard thing to find and get the timing right and meet someone at the right time. So I'm not just going to kind of sit around and wait for that to happen. I'm just trying to move the product forward until I find that person, basically.
Yeah. The vast majority of people can't take an enormous hit to their income for an extended period of time. I mean, this is related to that bootstrapping conversation that we want to have a little later on in this episode, but it is a matter of, it's like luck to find someone in just the right situation, just the right time, in between things. You like each other, you get along, the skill sets match up, and the interest in the product and the market is all matched up. It is just
it's really difficult to find. A lot of bootstrappers in our community are partnering up, and one or both of them have full-time jobs, or they're consulting most of the time to pay their bills
on the side.
Yeah. In my case, I mean, yeah, I'm running audience ops, but my time is freed up from that. Like, it's a productized service, and the team is running it, and I do have like a full-time week to devote to the new product, and that's what I'm doing. So if I'm going to partner with someone, I'm going to be so frustrated with the pace if they're consumed in something else. Like, I need someone who can give the same amount of hours that I can, you know.
Or you're gonna have to pay him a near full salary.
Is not an option right now, you know.
Yep. This is the chicken egg thing. It is just a very thing. So you went to Martha's Vineyard, and this is where you spent your time and focus and attention on basically how to figure out this puzzle of getting this product out in the right way. And where you ended up is you're gonna get this thing off the ground yourself and get it rolling.
Yeah, and it's not like I'm starting in terms of learning Rails. I'm not starting that now. I started that months ago. I've been learning, and I've been working with a coach, and like I do understand how to get this thing started. It's gonna be very complex, and I'm gonna go super slow at it because I'm figuring it out. But to get past those roadblocks, I've got a coach. I can outsource things, you know, but at least I can push on it. That's my thinking.
I love the rightful, ridiculous arrogance. I've been doing this for months, so it's not like I have to start from scratch.
all right, you know, but like
the arrogance is the wrong word, or at least it has a negative connotation, but it is the confidence to just say, well, I've done things that I shouldn't be able to do before, so I'll do this thing also. The cynical business side of it is the further along you get it, the better position you're in when you do inevitably bring on a partner, an employee, a co-founder, something. Just the further along it is, if it's generating revenue, if it's almost generating revenue, if you have interest, if you have an email list, every bit that you can store up on your side of the assets puts you in a better position for when you partner.
So on the business side, if I can get a product out to the market and get paying customers, that makes it that much more attractive for a partner, or who knows, maybe investors, like whatever that next step might be in the next year. To make the terms better, you need a product in the market with paying customers, and to do that, I need to create the product first, right? But even on the tech side, if it's going to get rebuilt later, it's even better if there was a first version and we learned a bunch of stuff and we have a bunch of data about how that first version went and what went wrong to rebuild off of, rather than you know, there's a lot of technical learning that's going to, we're going to need to get through too.
There's an issue of momentum being attractive. So the most qualified, most experienced, most talented people, they inevitably are very careful with where they put their time because they have a huge set of options. So the more momentum you have, the more attractive it is to talented people that can put their time anywhere, but they're choosing to put it with you. And the fact that you have momentum paying customers, that makes it much more realistic. I know the hardest thing was attracting that original co-founder that I worked with, Charlie. When I had nothing, I had to just create stuff. Look at all these people I'm talking to, and they said this, and they're willing to pay this if I can get X, Y, and Z. And then now we kind of not joke about it, but we are surprised. Now when we say, hey, we're looking for a new front-end engineer in Slovenia, and we post something in the Facebook group of Slovenian developers, and we get overwhelmed with people that want to join. And it's almost like, I don't know what it is, but they can tell that we have momentum and it's a place that you want to be. There's no risk in joining us. There's a lot lower risk than, hey, we're two people and we'd like a third person, please join us. It's a very different thing.
It's completely understandable that developers are in demand, but they have to be very careful with what they sink into. Even if it's even for paid gigs, it's like, is it even worth it to get involved in a software project or client that's not going anywhere or making poor decisions at the top and things like that? Like,
right. You know. I felt it last time I was in Slovenia. I did one-on-ones with everyone there. And one of the guys in my one-on-one, he basically said, Jordan, I just want you to know, I'm really happy here. I love it here. I got a job offer 2 weeks ago for literally almost double what you guys pay. But I have no interest in joining because this is fun and interesting and challenging. And I love the team. You know, so it's, yeah, the more attractive you can make your situation, there's infinite options out there. And a lot of them are, we'll give you money if you're willing to be miserable with us. And that's not attractive to the most talented people. All right, cool. Sounds like Martha's Vineyard was a valuable piece. And I love Ben, and I don't know who else was there, but I'm sure it was a great group.
Yeah, it was a good group. And so, I mean, on the process kit front, I've made a lot of progress on the designs. Those are basically pretty much done in terms of like how much I wanted to actually put into Sketch before I get into start coding.
The admin, the actual app?
The app, yeah. I started with like these lo-fi wireframes, and then I went into pretty detailed mock-ups because I'm in constant contact with, it's now a couple hundred people in Facebook, in a Facebook group and a Slack group. And every week I'm trying to show them some new piece of the designs.
That was my question. Are you sharing it along the way?
Yeah, yeah. That's different this time, man. Like this, it's so much better this way. Because last time I did the pre-selling. I forgot if we talked about this last time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we touched on this on how we wanted to do more in public and how powerful that can be.
Yeah, I haven't done pre-selling yet on Process Kit, but I have done a lot of one-on-one calls, and I'm doing these big group feedback sessions in Facebook and Slack, and I get a lot of feedback about pricing. Like yeah, we already pay for tools like this. I could definitely see this replacing certain tools. Like, when can I try it out? Things like that. And you know, I had very specific conversations about pricing and whatnot, but even more conversations about like, these are features that we need. Like, I would need it to work like this. And they're feeding off of the designs that I'm showing them. And they're seeing like I posted the workflow editor for processes the other day, and I'm getting some feedback on that. And so then I've also been going over the designs with my coding coach to figure out the technical plan as I start to architect the models and the relationships and how I'm going to, you know, crack into it. And so basically right now, I mean, I'm heading to Cabo Press next week, but I'm ready to kind of hit the ground running coming back from that trip. So code, and you know, we're in the middle of October. I'm going to hope to have some sort of functional app by, I don't know, December, January, something like that, maybe sooner.
Does it feel helpful to have that coach on just the guidance in terms of architecture and what to look out for?
So much. Yeah, I mean,
it's awesome.
I've already gone over how I laid out all the database models and the relationships and things like that. And he helped me kind of rework a few things in there. And he asked some technical questions about the designs, and we walked through those, and it's been really helpful, and I've got a much clearer idea, and I've done a bunch of practice projects on Rails. I already know like the different base gems and things that I'll be using for various parts of it. But
are you going to do like a bullet train type thing to kick things off the ground?
I might still use it. I'm thinking about, but I don't know.
So it's always a trade off.
I think it actually has a bunch of stuff that I really don't want or need. And as a pretty new Rails developer, I might have a harder time sifting through the stuff that I don't need. You know, so I think it might be easier for me to just keep it as simple as possible.
Makes sense, man. Very exciting.
How about you? What's up on your end?
Lot going on. You know, I think overall, I'm having a good time. It is feels like the past few years of work are starting to kind of turn this into something that felt like a fantasy a few years ago of organization. And, you know, we're starting to put in that first layer of management. So not everyone's reporting to me, and I'm starting to kind of be able to float out toward management and strategy as like my regular job and not feel guilty that I'm not doing the things that I quote supposed to be doing, because I'm now literally not supposed to be doing them.
Yeah. It's pretty incredible, man. For anybody who's listening to this podcast since the very beginning, a couple of years ago, wow. I mean, the trajectory of where you've come from. I mean, I think you started on this podcast before Carthook even started, right?
I think so. I think it was before. Yeah. So I've caught myself, you know, in some like moments of reflection by myself, like with like a smile on my face, you know, as I'm like, you really need to enjoy this. So I'm trying to like take that, and we're moving into a new office. And so I like go by there like once a week to see how the construction's doing. I kind of find myself standing alone in an empty office that's being constructed for like my company. And it feels great, man. It's a trip. And then the Slovenian office, they're outgrowing their office. So now we're looking for an office that fits 25 in Slovenia. I'm like, what are we talking about? So is a lot of those moments are kind of happening of like, is that real? Is that what we're planning for? You know, so it's a trip. So we're hiring 5 people right now. So we should be 2 are replacements. We had our first person resign. That hurt. It's interesting. It was the only person remote. So I took some of that responsibility myself. Like, you know, we don't have a remote first culture. And I think they were kind of left out there. Whereas I think if they were, you know, in the room with us, I think he would have come to me and said, look, I'm ready for something else. Or here's where I'm thinking about my trajectory, or, you know, but that disconnect was like, yo, these guys offered me so much more money in this new position. So it didn't feel right to him to be like, hey, this is what I really want to do next. So whatever it was, so that happened, but now, yeah, we'll have the 2 offices, this new management layers.
The new management layer is, which role is that? The COO or the?
So at this point in time, we've set things up with 3 C-level. So CEO, CTO, and then CPO, right? Chief Product Officer. So the Chief Product Officer is here with me in the office, and so that just makes a lot of sense. Not only for the role, but also for the proximity. So the people here in Portland that were normally reporting directly to me are now starting to report directly to him much more. And then we collaborate, and I'm still involved, obviously, but I am doing other stuff.
Yeah. How has that transition gone with the communication within the team? Like, do people still come to you with stuff when they should be coming to them before you?
It's happening less. And so I'm looked at as like the resource. I'm like, hey, we're between this and this. What do you think about that? And then it's like my input. It's not me being like, well, I'm telling you to do exactly this. It's like a guidance thing, or like a, hey, what about you? What's your take on it? Let's go see what Jordan thinks. Okay, we've debated this for a while. Let's go see what Jordan's take on it is. It's kind of like being helpful, but it almost like is necessary for me to acknowledge that I'm not the subject expert on what you're talking about. You guys do this all day, and you've been arguing about it for an hour. I'm really enjoying seeing that, and kind of like looking over to the other side of the office and seeing 3 people pointing at a screen arguing with each other is like, yeah, there you go. You guys are kind of off and running. I'm not involved in that conversation. They care about the outcome. they're experts because they're bringing months and months, if not, you know, over a year of experience dealing with that particular issue. We're definitely not done, man. It feels like years from being done. That's what it feels like.
In terms of the product, you mean?
Yes. It feels like we have a really strong market fit, but it's not aligned with the product market fit. It's not bang. It's not clicked in. And so we have a lot of people that really want to use it, but it isn't quite right, or it's missing this and it's missing that. And then it becomes this crazy challenge of, we know what we need to do. What do we do first? What's the priority? We've set things up in like stages. We call it like P0, P1, P2, like priority zero. That's what we're working on right now. P1s are what's coming up, P2s. And we've kind of made that very public. Everyone can see which features are in which bucket.
Oh, do you mean public within the company or to customers?
So it's actually two different things, right? So what we do is we take the roadmap, we put it into the P0, P1, P2 buckets and so on. And then we assign next to those. So if there's a specific feature that we do not want people to know about, then that is a confidential feature. And then the other ones are, you can share. And what you can share is that this bucket has an expected release of January, right? So it's ambiguous and it's way in the distance. So we're not over promising. Like, what did you want? What feature? Let me look at that. That's a P2. Yes. And it's not confidential. Yes. That's on our roadmap. And we expect that in the first quarter of 2019. So it's just like simplified.
And that like informs your support team or whoever's talking to customers.
Exactly right. And then it's a uniform message from support. And there's no ambiguity of, can I tell people about this feature? Are we okay telling them? So it's, everyone's on the same page. And this is the message that we give to everybody. And then what we did along with that is, last week at stand-up that we normally do, relatively informal, our stand-up goes like this. Our regular stand-up goes, Jordan talks for 5 minutes about, how was your weekend? Hope everyone's well. Here's some fun stuff. Here's where we're going. Here are one or two things that I kind of want to make sure everyone knows about. I congratulate someone on a promotion. Just like management-y type stuff. Then each of the team leads goes and talks about what's happening in their world for about 5 minutes. And we work down the funnel. So we go marketing talks, success, support, product, tech. So it's like the funnel of a customer, basically. And then I wrap it up by saying, all right, it's the beginning of the quarter. Let's kick some butt. Here are our goals. Let's make sure we're doing it. All right. Talk to everybody soon. Have a great week. So that's like our normal stand-up. This stand-up was, okay, it's the beginning of the quarter. Jordan's going to go make a slide deck with 15 slides, and we're going to communicate on roadmap, KPIs, milestones, tech, like all these categories, right? Like financing and all this stuff. And instead of just saying the words that just kind of float away, we're going to put it on a deck and everyone's going to be able to look at it visually. And it was the first time I've ever done that. And afterward, people like clapped. They were like, that was not clapped for my performance, but like, thank you. That was helpful. It removed a lot of ambiguity for people. So that is definitely something that I will do once a quarter. And I can wrap that up into the investor update on basically saying, here's the deck that we're presenting internally. So now it gives an insight to investors on what's happening inside the company. What are employees, what are they seeing from management, and then management's reporting up to me effectively as an investor. So it gives a little more insight into that.
Very cool. What I found in the last year or two with Audience Ops, I did make that separation where I have a team manager who all the day-to-day stuff basically goes to her, and then she escalates stuff to me. And occasionally people still kind of come to me with certain things, and then I just say like CC Cat, like or someone who knows that part of the business, and like, and I try to like offload it that way. But then what I found was, things that get escalated to me are usually just the problems. This isn't always the case, but if something went wrong, it probably comes to my inbox. And so now it's like, whenever anything comes to my inbox, I'm like, shit, what is it? You know,
you know, if anything, whatever the nature of our business is, my fear is when I don't get the problems. Like yesterday, by coincidence, I saw that someone was being an absolute jerk to support, like just completely out of line. And they don't want me to see that. But when I see that, I'm like, no, this customer is getting fired right now. That's unacceptable. So when that thing happens, I'm like, what are they hiding from me? Because they don't want to bother me, right? Where I do want to see the problems. It's definitely been a challenge for me because my instinct when I get an email and someone's asked me something that feels like my responsibility, I want to respond. So I've been trying to stretch that out and hand off things that I normally would want to do and just hand them off as much as possible. And I'm trying to keep the things that the company really wants me to be doing over, like the things that only I should really be doing right now. And I'm sure those will change also. So in 2 weeks, I'm going to LA for a conference with our most important integration partner, Recharge. So they're putting on a conference for 2 days. They asked me to speak. That's my job. Like I should, and eventually someone else will be able to do that just fine. But right now that I need to do. It's moving around. It's definitely not clear, and I'm definitely not there yet in understanding where the lines are on what I should be doing, what I should be handing off.
Maybe that goes to the in-house versus remote team sort of thing. I mean, with us, since we're fully remote, we go above and beyond to have everything documented online somewhere. I don't mean just processes. I mean like communications. So everything either happens in a Trello comment or in a Help Scout thread or in Slack, or, you know, even like our calls that we have with clients and with the team, like get recorded and logged and things like that. Like, not that like I'm going in and listening to call recordings, although I mean, I almost never do, but like, you know, we have processes to make sure that every happening is documented so that anybody who's based anywhere can always have that visibility. But still there, like I definitely run into that issue where I'm not hearing everything. I know that there's stuff that happens that flies under my radar and that people don't really want to escalate.
Yes. Slack really needs to create like a God mode. I want to see all the DMs, man, that are happening.
I know. There's a lot of DMs. I think especially my managers understand this, that like, even if a client is being an asshole, like that doesn't reflect on you as a manager. We have, or, you know, customer support, whatever you might want to call them. We have processes and policies for how we handle asshole clients, you know, and I try to make that as predictable as possible. Yeah, it's still stressful no matter what, but at least it's like, all right, well, we know you just need to escalate this and then we get it dealt with. That's it, you know?
Yeah. It should be right. More cold. Let's talk bootstrapping a little bit. It is a difficult topic. So just to kind of orient where the conversation is, Justin Jackson's doing some of the most important work on this. I think he's just pushing things with honesty and authenticity that is required to have this conversation, which is a difficult conversation.
I really like what he's been putting out there.
It's not two sides. Really what he's talking about, let's be fully honest about bootstrapping. Is that an accurate characterization, that let's acknowledge the downside of bootstrapping? Let's not glorify it. Maybe that's where the conversation started.
I think what Justin does so well in all of his writing and in his podcasting and everything is that he does a great job of touching on like the emotion behind these business decisions that we all go through, especially as bootstrappers. Like what I'm hearing from him in his recent articles and podcasts about this, and he's been on like Tropical MBA, and there's been some talk elsewhere and stuff about all
great,
these kind of
great podcast episode with on Tropical MBA.
Like, I guess I'm just hearing like it's really challenging, and also trying to make the math work. They're talking about like how soon is this going to get to profitability as a SaaS, and is it even viable? Like, should we continue on the path that we're on? And like, without getting into specifics of their business or our business, I like the side of what he's saying, which is this is really fucking hard. and it's stressful, and it has an impact on our families and our well-being and all that. I don't know if maybe it's if he's necessarily saying this or if others are saying this, but I've started to sense this trend that I kind of want to push back on here a little bit, which is it seems like now in 2018, more people are starting to paint a picture of hey, bootstrapping and self-funding is not what it used to be, and it's a lot harder now and maybe impossible now. And like maybe you should think twice before you go out and try to self-fund your online startup. And I want to push back on that idea because I still believe that bootstrapping and self-funding and stair-stepping, whatever you want to call this, is very much still possible. And there are different scenarios, different phases in your career and in your product that you're trying to build where I think it's smarter to go the bootstrapped route still now than immediately look to fund strapping or raising money or whatever. Like, and I can talk about different things. I've done this. Like I've gone through freelancing into building agencies, into productized services, into selling businesses and leveraging off of that, into more productized services and building teams to run the business without me so that I have free time. I know plenty of people who work a remote job. Like they just get a paycheck from a remote job, but it doesn't take up their entire week. It leaves them with a chunk of hours that they can devote to a startup. And there are plenty of people who do consulting and they raise their rates to allow for fewer projects, more money to pay the bills. And like there are things that you can still do. Info products, and I'm not saying it's easy to just overnight launch a book or a course and make money, but you can build an audience. People do that. And it takes a long time. It took me years. I'm still building. It took Nathan Barry and Brennan Dunn and Rob Walling years, but they did that. And look, it worked for them. They were able to self-fund and bootstrap their startups. That still does happen today. Those options are still out there.
It does happen, but going out and raising $8 million in a $2 million seed round in San Francisco and having that work out, that happens all the time too. I think where we are in the conversation here is that VC was over-glorified. It was, this is the only way to do it. If you're a real entrepreneur, you go out and you raise money and that's your validation. And then you could get congratulated for raising money instead of for producing a business that actually satisfies customers, makes money and revenue and profit. Okay, that went overboard. What happened was that the bootstrap community, ourselves included, looked at that and called bullshit, rightfully to a large degree. And then we started to over-glorify the bootstrapping route as like, that's the authentic way. That's the right way to focus on revenue and profit and customers, and you don't need funding and you don't need any of that, and bootstrapping is the right way to go. And I think what Justin's doing now is he's going through it himself.
Maybe correcting for that a bit.
A little bit, coming off of the glorification of that just a touch, because it's what Justin's great at is communicating his experience as he's going through it. So right now he's got a SaaS and all of a sudden he looks at the math like, oh shit, this is going to take forever to get to a place where we're making a decent salary that even remotely compares to what I could go walk into an office tomorrow and someone will start paying me. That is a very serious thing, especially when you start talking about grownups with kids and houses and mortgages and issues and all that stuff.
I think that definitely is fair. I think you're right. I think our communities do need that correction of, okay, bootstrapping is not always, or self-funding, whatever you want to call it, is not always the be-all end-all option and you shouldn't ever consider other options. But I would want to try to correct that first by saying, like, I don't think there's been enough of a focus on pricing and that's hard to say. There's the charge more conversations that have been happening for years, but still it's like there hasn't been enough realism about, okay, if you're bootstrapping, then you have to move fast. There's no way around that. You have to do whatever you can to move fast because you are on a much tighter runway than any other options. So,
right. I think what you're saying is let's not say that it doesn't happen anymore and it's impossible. That's not right either. I think what we're talking about is reality, and reality is nuanced. It's there's no black and white. It's not clear cut. It is important for us to acknowledge, much the same way that younger people and people earlier on in their entrepreneurial journey looked at VC and you get swept away and you think that's the only way to do it, and that's unhealthy. It's the same thing with the bootstrapping thing. We shouldn't give off the impression that this is like a religion, and if you don't do it exactly like this and don't take any outside money at all, then you're doing it wrong. Because one of the most important things that Justin talked about in that conversation with Dan on the Tropical MBA podcast, he called it texture, right? I don't know what the right word for it is, but there's always something going on behind the scenes in almost everybody's bootstrapping story that doesn't quite fit with the romantic narrative of I went for it alone and I just cared about my customers and I grew my business and I didn't take outside money. There's texture. I know my texture is complicated and hidden, right? Nobody knows that first year of Cardhook that I ate shit and took no money. The only reason I was able to do that is because I worked with my dad the previous business. And that business had this weird thing where you do work 1 year, but you don't get paid for 12 months. So I did all that work and then I had money coming in for 12 months. It's the only way I even had a chance to be able to make it through that year. But that's not romantic and that's not part of the bootstrap story.
It's conversations like that that I think help this community that make it more real. And look, like everybody has some sort of advantage. And you can and you almost have to take advantage of that, of whatever advantage you can possibly have, whether it's a spouse and you're living off of their healthcare instead of yours, and that enables you to go quit your job, or you don't have kids yet and you can spend your entire weekends and nights working on your product. If that's what you want to do, if you don't want to be employed forever, then yeah, you got to work extra hours. And I'm not trying to get into this like, oh, hustle, and like, you know, you got to kill yourself, because I don't believe in that either. At my age now, I don't believe in that. I'm 36. When I was 26, I did work crazy hours because I wanted to and I had the energy and I didn't have kids, you know? And I wanted to change the picture of what I was looking at. I wasn't happy in employment. I wasn't happy in freelancing. So I woke up super early and I worked on weekends and I built the first business and then I sold it. I'm not saying that happened overnight. It took 4 years. But you can bootstrap and sell something and then do it again. You can build teams. You can start to learn how to outsource. You can start to learn how to delegate. There are different options, and not every option is not right for every person, right? Like there are certainly people who don't want to do what I did, build out teams, processes and systems and like with a productized service and have a business that basically runs without me in the day to day. Like, I know that that's not for everyone. Same thing with building an audience and info products and courses. Not everyone is into the idea of building an audience and putting themselves out there and teaching for a living. But those are options that some people can do and can invest in over time, you know?
You know, where the rubber meets the road is in the revenue. And the issue on that side is that it almost always takes so much longer than you expect. And the most expensive thing in an endeavor is your time, your salary that you just need in order to survive. And replacing that with SaaS is crazy. It takes so long. And everyone should be realistic about that. And people should be realistic about, hey, I've been at this for 6 months and I'm at, you know, $120 in recurring revenue. Maybe I should just stop. Right. So there's just a lot to deal with on that front. And then the piece that I am really, really interested in over the next few years is the financing. There has not been that much innovation in financing. It kind of overlooks our market. It goes into, well, I am a VC and I've raised $50 million from these institutions that are looking for a return. I can't go invest $100,000 as my bet. I need different math. Otherwise, that's not my business. And then the public markets have nothing to do with us, right? But what we need to acknowledge is that innovation in financing leads to innovation in business. The public corporation is still a brand new thing. The fact that you could raise money from strangers was mind-blowing, and that allowed for the public markets to be able to raise as much money and build businesses that were large, that required that level of funding. So now the VC is its own thing, and it's not really right for us. And then there's indie VC, there's revenue financing, there are Lightfoot Capital, the loaners, there's stuff happening. but it isn't quite there yet. What I would love to see is I would love to see people coming out of the Bootstrap community, knowing what it is like, and then figuring out a business model where they can go raise $1 million, $2 million in a fund and be able to make these $25,000, $50,000 bets that don't have to lead up to much bigger bets that can build sustainable businesses, maybe get exits, maybe get dividends, whatever. So I always keep an eye on what IndieVC is doing and how they change their terms. I think they're on their third version of their terms. And looking at the way they position their terms for the money that they give is a direct reflection from what they're hearing from the community of people who is not looking specifically for an exit. So that's I always keep an eye out for where their terms are.
Those developments, those conversations are getting more and more interesting. For a lot of people listening to shows like this and others, I think it's great that those options are becoming available, because it's almost like there's kind of like a light at the end of the hard early road, where it's like if you can take a product up to product market fit and you have customers and you have a product built and you can see a road ahead, like you know what you would do if you had 500 or a million in the bank. It's great to know that there are options now to go and do that and keep the runway going. Not that people are really suggesting this, but there's been so much talk about those options out there now that it's almost like, well, what does it take to be in a position where you can actually command pretty good terms if you're going to go that route? You know, it takes bootstrapping and stair-stepping one thing onto the next. Like, and that's a long game too. I mean, it's like if you're in a job or if you're freelancing right now, you can't expect to come out and have a winning SaaS idea within 12 months. You have to start to take steps that can position you to be in that in the next 5 years or something. You know, like I'm not saying don't work on that idea until 5 years from now. I'm just saying that like it's think big picture. Everything that you decide to work on, you should think about how you might leverage that to grow and free up more time to be able to go do more things, you know?
Yeah. And it doesn't have to be SaaS. SaaS is unbelievably painful. There are other business models out there and other types of products to sell and services. The dreaded service. There are most businesses are service businesses, if I'm not wrong.
And most SaaS are offering services. Whenever you see a SaaS pricing page and that column on the right that says enterprise, contact us, that's a contact form that leads to a service engagement, and they're charging thousands and thousands of dollars for that. Like,
we are in the middle of it right now. We are talking to Salesforce to get our CRM game in order so that we can identify the best customers and offer them more services. It's just the nature of it. I'm in a Slack with a bunch of people, and someone came in and was like, please excuse my therapy session. I'm just kind of alone in this and just need to kind of get this out. And they just wrote out, I don't want to call it heartbreaking, but it's tough to read, man. You know, it's like things are going well, but where do you go from there if you don't have resources? And this is something we talk about regularly here in Portland with our group. We call it the desert. That at some point, you get into this spot where, okay, I have something going, but how much longer can I just keep burning savings? But to get to that next level where I can pay myself a sufficient salary so I can keep doing this, that seems unattainable without money to do more stuff to get there. And I'm just in between. And you're just in the desert, baby. And there's really not that much to do. I don't know if it's a saying that I made up or someone made up. I don't know. I heard it somewhere. But the only thing to do when you're walking through a desert is keep going.
Yeah. As risky as it might be to keep burning savings or get funding or whatever, it's equally a bad decision to just give up at that point. Like, you got to keep going. So you got to figure something out in that middle area.
Like, that's where the heartbreak is. And it's also where the potential is. Because people going from their job to that point to, I have a product that people want to buy and there are people who are currently buying it, that no one's going to help you on. Use whatever unfair advantages you have, savings, your brother-in-law, whatever.
But I mean, like, I know people who built really valuable productized services while having a job. And not just productized services, other things. But leveraging that to their advantage because they have a paycheck. So they don't need the thing to be profitable. They can invest 2 years in hiring people without having to pay yourself. And then that enables you to go quit your job and go do other, like start to totally change your math. I mean,
yes, that is the hustle of entrepreneurship. And that is a beautiful thing to see happen all over the world. It's beautiful. It's an amazing thing. Where the bootstrap, that conversation is right where that guy who posted in that Slack, where you're like, damn, that's what he was talking about. He said, I don't know. I don't want to take money. I've never taken money. I'm completely self-funded. And they're like, I don't know what to do in this spot. And that's like,
I think about this a lot with Process Kid. I'm just starting it up now. And I think I can sustain it a while self-funding. And maybe that's a combination of me building it for a while and then somebody else helping me out with building it and working with me on it. But at a certain point, I could see that coming to the end of the line of me sustaining that and you know, sustaining my family and everything to a point where it's like, okay, hey, we have customers. So now it might make sense to keep the line going and seek funding or some, or, you know, to pay our salaries for another year or two so that we can keep going on this. Like that could be a reality. I don't know, but I wouldn't want to go to that point until it justifies. And maybe it doesn't even ever have to get to that point. Like it's just that there are options, I think.
Yeah. Tough stuff, man.
I think we circled around it enough.
Yeah. Look, it's a good conversation to have and for people to hear and think about. And, you know, business, man, this is not easy stuff.
I like the honesty going around, you know, from Justin and everybody else who's out there putting podcasts out. And, you know, I was just on Ben and Derek's Art of Product podcast. And I was telling them that, like, there needs to be more of these kind of podcasts, you know, like what you and me, what they're doing over there, and like Craig and Dave, and like even Rob and Mike. I mean, they're like rock stars in the podcasting industry at this point, but
yeah, but they keep it real, the same as years ago. You know what makes me think of? Yesterday, I spoke to another entrepreneur here. She's like super awesome. She's like a professional kiteboarder, and she has a bikini company. And she was telling me about she listened to, what's it called? The How I Built This?
Yeah.
She was like, it was such an amazing episode. RX Bar sold for like, what, billions of dollars, like 5 years in. And I told her, you know what? I don't listen to those anymore. Because all those do is they make me compare myself to them, and then I don't feel good about myself. And I don't want that. I want to feel good about myself. You know, I don't want to compare myself to freak show rock stars that lightning struck. Like, that doesn't make sense. And then in the next breath, I was like, you know, our podcast is not that at all. It is not the highlights. If anything, it's the lowlights. Yeah.
I want our podcast to be as boring and uninteresting to most of the world, but who knows? I don't know how many people listen to this, but our little circle of listeners, like,
yes.
It's you cool to know that, like,
better about yourself, not yeah. worse.
Yeah. Oh, that's exactly. Good. Yeah, but cool, I like tuning into to, you know, friends podcasts and just hear their week to week of what they're working on. So
cool, man. Stuff. Well, it's great to catch up. You're off to sunny Cabo San Lucas next week. That's awesome. I'm going to LA on Monday, so there's that.
Awesome.
All right. Take it easy, everyone. Talk soon, bro.
All right, later, man.